Digital 410 proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II based. That's an important message for tonight, World War II based podcast. Henry is still out working on his book. Jeff's got things going on. That's okay. We're going back old school. We're going back with a one-on-one episode. And I said tonight, an important part of our theme is base, because tonight we're going to go back before World War II. We're going to go back to the Great Depression. And some interesting facts I found out through watching videos and then watching a semi-historical fiction movie called Amsterdam, which I thought was very interesting and brought me up to speed on what I thought was fictional, until I do what I always do, which is get out the Google box and start Googling characters from this movie. And I found out, yes, the movie is fake, but the through line was based on true events, and true events that I was surprised I'd never really heard of, considering I've been running a World War II-based podcast since 2018, and I have been reenacting since, 11 years now. So I did what I always do. I need to find somebody who knows more than me on this particular subject, and I found a gentleman. Colin, welcome to the show. First and foremost, let me just put this out there. For those of you familiar with Mr. Colin D. Heaton, yes, he knows a lot about aviation. No, we're not going to talk about it tonight because Jeff would kill me, because as you guys know, Jeff is a huge World War II aviation fan, and the fact that Colin did some consulting on Masters of the Air, we won't get into that tonight, but perhaps if everything goes according to plan tonight, we'll have Colin on a future episode with Jeff and Henry, and we'll talk World War II aviation. But right now, we're going to focus on the Great Depression shortly. More importantly, the Bonus Army March, and then what has become known to be as the quote-unquote business plan. But Colin, how are you doing tonight, sir?
Oh, pretty good.
I appreciate
just working on a few projects.
What are you working on now? I know you just released a book earlier this year, which was Above the Pacific, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm working on a few film projects right now with some people. Put things together and getting contacts ready for investor meetings, things like that.
Fantastic. I guess maybe when things come to fruition, you can come on and promote those. But give our audience a little bit more history about you, other than the fact that you write fantastic books. You have quite a library of books, and we will include all those over on WTSP World War II. We'll put a link to you can see and purchase Colin's books. But give our audience a little background on you. I understand you not only served in the Army, but the Marine Corps. Is that correct?
Yeah, I served 3 years in the Army, got out, and a friend of mine was a recruiter for the Corps, and he suggested that I go back to work. And so I took him up on his offer, and I did. So I spent a few years there. And then after that, I went to college and then graduate school, then postgraduate school, began teaching and writing, and all during those years, I would travel between Europe and the U.S., and I was always interviewing, Africa, but I was interviewing people, mostly World War II vets, but I got a couple of World War I veterans that are still alive, so.
You're the few who were lucky enough to get those.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I got two Germans and three Americans and one British gentleman.
And the fact that we, you know, film was at such an early adaptation back then. Clearly, obviously, we don't have half as much as the context and content we do on World War II. And so for you to get the verbal memories from those gentlemen probably meant a lot to you and provided tremendous value to you and your colleagues.
Well, yeah, but I did it as a hobby for 20, 30 years, because some people collect stamps, some people collect coins, comic books. I collected people's stories. I collected interviews. That was what I wanted to do. And when I was in high school, I was in middle school when I was able to meet General Omar Bradley and talk to him. And we had a pretty good short conversation, not an interview. But and then later on, I became acquainted with a few authors who I had written to courtesy of their publishing companies. And one became a very good friend, Colonel Raymond F. Tolliver, who introduced the world to the German fighter pilots, but he had good contacts. And so I began writing letters and had phone calls. And over a period of time, I was able to get together with most of these gentlemen and some women and start compiling a library, which I never really thought I'd be writing books about these people until I found out that, some of these books are pretty popular, but also found out it was the most difficult thing other than a blind man probing a minefield was getting a book published.
Yeah.
So, but once I cracked the secret and had a couple of good agents, my latest agent I'm still with for 17 years, I guess now.
Congratulations on that.
So once you have a good agent and you've got a decent product, it's just a matter of finding the right publishing company.
And that's a huge thing, whether it's being an author, a musician, an actor, an athlete. Those industries in and of itself, anytime you attach the word entertainment or money to it, there are so many people looking for a quick way to scam others. And as you said, once you find a good agent, you got to hold on to them with all their worth and just trust them. They trust you. You got to build that relationship. And once you get a good one who's not out to, you know, pull a fast one, especially when you're up and coming, you know, you're young and to whatever your particular industry is, it's just like anything else. There's always those people out there looking to take advantage of others. And once you find a good one, you just got to hold on to them.
Oh yeah. And I got lucky because my friend, who's also my entertainment lawyer, knew her, and she had represented some very prestigious authors in the past. She was Eric Hamill's agent for a while.
Oh, okay.
And so she carried a lot of weight, in the military history. All she represents is military history. So she specializes, and we've had a great working relationship. So,
well, that's part of the reason why Henry can't be here tonight. I'm not sure if you're aware, but Henry has basically recovered. When his father put out with the old breed, the original manuscript, I think, was roughly 640 pages, but the publisher said, hey, we're only interested in about 350. And so some of that context went on to be China Marine, but a lot of it has never been seen, never been published. And so Henry's actually taken his father's, the remaining part of that manuscript, and he's reworking on it and adding his sense experience with his father post-war and some of his father's tellings and memories of it. And he's actually working on a book in an effort to get his father's unpublished work out there into the world, so, you know, fans of Eugene Sledge can get more content from his father. And so that's why he's kind of stepped away from the show. He's still part of the show, but he's on hiatus just because he's working a full-time job and trying to get that book out. And as you know, getting a book out, especially when it's going to be your first one, it takes a lot of time to get that just right.
Well, I mean, the good thing is, I mean, he's working off his dad's work, which Eugene Sledge's memoir is like legendary in the Marine Corps. And
absolutely.
It's like absolute, it's required reading. And if I give an example, that's not that unusual, because I'm going to release the second edition of my book, The Star of Africa, because I had a word count restriction. I had to be well below 100,000 words, but I had like 130 some odd thousand words worth of material. They said, no, you got to trim it down. So how do you cut out great stuff and still tell the story? So I did the best I could, but now that I have a new publisher, in fact, Dale Dye and his wife, Julia, their publishing company, Warrior Publishing, are going to take care of it and get the second edition out.
Congratulations on that. Is it easier when you're, I don't want to say easier, but is it the process quicker when you go back and pull up material you had already written? Or is it harder because now you got to figure out how to take that content that's already had the beginning and the end cut off of it and then retell it in a new way, but still get to that part of the timeline that was cut out of the original book?
Well, for me, it was really easy because I had the original manuscript, and all I had to do is edit the original manuscript. That I kept a copy of the long version, and I trimmed down the short version for the first edition book that came out in 2012, but I still had the long version. So I didn't have to do any extracurricular work on that. It was already there. I just had to make sure it had a better edit. And then I had more information that I gathered from over the years from a gentleman in Australia whose uncle was killed by the subject of the book, The Star of Africa. And I managed to get some stuff from him that I also wanted in the book. But what I left out of the first edition was a lot of interview material that I had with a lot of the Allied pilots, Australians, South Africans, Canadian, and even other Germans, and expanded interview material that really told the story of Hans Marseille, because they either fought against him or they flew with him, they knew him. And so the story it's a more well-rounded version of that man's life and the people he knew and the people who were involved, because now you have a broader picture. And I'm sure that when he releases the additional unpublished material from his father's book, it's going to be a more complete picture of what he wanted to say.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask. Clearly, you wrote the original manuscript in 2012. I'm assuming it took you a few years of research, but clearly the internet has come a long way, and people who, since 2012, more and more analog documents have probably been digitized, put into databases. Did you find that when you're working on the material that you collected in 2012 and you researched, and now that you're fine-tuning it, and I'm assuming you probably went out and did some additional research, did you find that you're finding stuff that you weren't aware of back then just because more content is being digitized and made more readily available on the internet?
A couple of things that were new to me that I did not know had survived the war, but I didn't really have to do a lot of digging for them because a lot of my historian friends loved the book and they want to see the full story told. And Robert Tate, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Tate, he's retired now, but he wrote a book on Hans-Joachim Marseille, which I thought was a great book, and then mine came out. So we were competing books with the same subject. But Bob Tate really helped out with some information, and an Australian researcher named Nick Hector, he's become a friend, he helped out with a lot of additional material that I did not have access to because I've not been to Australia. So really, a lot of the stuff that's online, a lot of it you can't trust unless it is from an archive. But I spent so much time in the archives in Germany and in Britain and in France and Italy and going through documentation and Canada, that it was nice to have corroborating material from other sources, you know? And my problem that I like to solve is mysteries. And mysteries I like to solve is what Bob Tate does and Nick Hector does and I did. And we would like to, if there was an air combat involving a German or an American, British pilot, whoever, and he shot down somebody, how much luck are we going to have finding out who that guy was he shot down? And that's what I became pretty good at. Bob's great at it. Nick's great at it. And what I did over the years was I was able, if they were still alive, most of my interviews were with the Germans, the Luftwaffe guys, but I give an example. I interviewed Walter Kropinski the first time with Steinhoff in 84. And then around 2000, I managed to figure out, or 1999, I guess, I managed to figure out who this one particular Soviet pilot was that Kropinski shot down. Wow. I found out he was still alive. And the story goes that Kropinski was in a big dogfight with Günther Rall and Hartmann and Steinhoff and Rabach. I mean, the legends of JG-52. And Kropinski had flamed this guy up. But he pulled alongside him, much like Marseille would do. And he motioned to the guy. And Kropinski said to me, he was just a child. He looked like he was 15 years old. Yeah. So he motions to the guy, go ahead and jump out. I'm not going to kill you. So the guy jumps out. And he remembered the aircraft markings. And he put it into his after action report. And I was talking to a friend of mine in Russia who had fled Russia. He's not exactly on Putin's Christmas list.
I can imagine not.
Yeah, but he was this was back in 97 and 98, and he was a historian, Russian historian, and he said, give me the information about that, the date, the time, and all that. And so after about a year or so, we cross-referenced, and I found out that this Ukrainian pilot was still alive, so I managed to get him to come to the Gemeinschaft der Jagdflieger, because I would go, you know, every year that I could to Germany for the World War II reunion. And I managed to get Kropinski to meet the guy that he let live. And the guy showed up with his wife, his daughter, his son, three grandkids, a great-grandchild. And the guy didn't speak German, and Kropinski didn't speak Russian. But we had a Russian interpreter there. And my Russian is terrible. My German's pretty good, but my Russian's terrible. But finally, Krupinski had told the guy, he said, well, I'm glad you lived because you have a beautiful family. And the guy broke down and cried, and his wife cried, and they hugged each other. He said, if you had killed me, I wouldn't have this wonderful family.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could probably cut the emotions in that room with a, you know, with a piece of cheesecake just because it had to be so thick. I mean, I could only imagine to be just a fly in the wall in that situation where you have two gentlemen who interacted with each other, depending on when this reunion started, anywhere between 60 to 85 years ago, and then had their family, their children, their great-grandchildren there. I couldn't imagine.
And that was great. I mean, there were so many stories like that that I mean, Saburo Sakai, the Japanese ace, I mean, he finally got to meet the co-pilot of a DC-3 that he did not shoot down because he saw it was carrying women and children fleeing Indonesia. Wow. And so he waved his other pilots off and said, you know, we're not going to shoot this guy down, you know, as civilians, we don't do that kind of thing. And then later on, that KLM pilot had showed up with his family and met Saburo, and, you know, and so these are the kinds of stories I like to get out there. Like one of the books I want to write, everyone can write about battles. I've written about battles. I've written about, you know, war crimes. I wrote a book called Occupation Insurgency. I interviewed the last living, 12 SS generals.
Wow.
But I want to tell the stories of the humanity of war.
The guys
who spent years trying to kill each other, but because they didn't lose their humanity, that they did something that would be totally abstract, abnormal, and probably get a few of them shot, but they did it anyway. Then that's what my book, The Star of Africa, was about, because Marseille shot down, he was credited with 158 aircraft, but and he killed a lot of pilots, but that wasn't his intent. But he ended up saving, mathematically calculating, the guys he let bail out, the guys he allowed to crash land, and the guys that he allowed to become prisoners of war, or the people who were wounded that he couldn't get to, that he would fly to the enemy airbase or write a note in perfect English and say, your guy shot down here, these coordinates, go get him. He saved 17 lives that he could have taken, but he didn't. And to me, that's the best part of the story, other than the fact that he, you know, really pissed off Hitler, Goering, Himmler, and Bormann, and the rest of them during a piano concert where he played jazz. But the humanity stories. You know,
yeah.
There are so many. I've got probably 100 such stories. Most people would be stunned to know that SS Lieutenant General Paul Hauser and Brigadier General, later at the end of the war, he's promoted Brigadier General Leon de Grel, the Belgian SS commander of the Legion of Wallonia, actually cleared an entire village in the Ukraine. And when they cleared the village, they found that the civilians came up out of these holes in the ground, and they were talking to them. And make a long story short, they said, well, where is your priest? Because all the priests had either been killed by the NKVD or sent to gulags. And so they had a priest in hiding and brought him out. So Gila and de Grel got permission from Hitler and Himmler to rebuild the church that had been damaged. So they rebuilt the church. They had soldiers set all around the perimeter on a Sunday service, so they could have their first church service since the Bolshevik Revolution.
Wow!
This was in 1942, and I thought that was a pretty wild story. And I actually managed to meet an older lady who was a teenage girl at the time, who says, "I remember those men because they said, 'Come on in, come on in.' We thought they were going to take us into the building and burn us, and shoot us." Now, Gila and de Grel and the other SS officers and some of the men sat down who were Catholics, and they sat down and went through the service like everybody else. And then they made sure a food truck showed up and gave the people food. And, you know, and it's just a wild story, and people don't really hear those stories.
Well, speaking of stories that a lot of people don't hear, we're definitely going to have you on for a follow-up episode, because I could clearly just wipe the table and just continue down this road. But I really want to get these stories across, because Jeff and I was talking a few episodes back. Jeff has been reading a lot more on World War One. I just kind of fell into the depression. I started watching YouTube videos, and I came across the story of what happened with the breaking up of the Bonus Army. But before we get there, let's go back a little bit. And from what I understand, to try to simplify an unsimple history of what happened to cause the depression. The way I understand it, in a very interesting documentary I watched, they kind of compared when the stock market opened to the public, because prior to that it was kind of just a rich man, you know, behind the scenes corporate thing. When the stock market opened up to the public and you start having all these stock traders, and now as a public everyday Joe, you could call one of these stock traders, buy some stocks. The stock market kind of blew up amongst the public, kind of like the internet did with us in the mid-2000s. Everybody's getting on chat rooms and this and that. And I was watching this documentary that was saying, you know, they had ticker tapes in beauty salons. They had ticker tapes in, you know, offices. And everywhere is ticker tapes. And from what I understand, when the stock market opened to the public, the stock traders were basically selling stocks without actually collecting money. When it first started, yeah, they started collecting money, and then they just basically start giving it out on credit. Because not only did the stock market up, but the whole concept of buying things on credit, and the whole credit system opened up. And so now you have people buying stocks on credit. The stock trader's not collecting any cash for it because they know, well, I'm just going to take the cash when, say, sell this in 2 or 3 weeks. And so many people start doing this. Well, when no one's actually paying anything and there's no cash being handed over for this stuff, and then all of a sudden it's time to collect. Well, we didn't expect this. No one collected any cash when we were selling all this stuff. Kind of sounds like the housing market of 2008. I mean, it just, the whole bubble just popped, right? Am I missing out on something there?
No, you're pretty much right. The standard procedure was anyone who wanted to buy stock could put 10% down. The rest was basically taken on credit. And when you had, you know, tens of millions of people, and bear in mind, this wasn't just in the U.S., this was all over the world. And people were not paying full value of the stock shares they bought. They were putting deposits down. The rest of it was given on credit. A lot of it was just given on IOUs, crazy as it sounds. Yeah. And then what it ended up being was the world's largest Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
Because pretty soon, some of these businesses were kind of starting to fail. People were living beyond their means. They couldn't afford this new dishwasher. Well, not dishwasher. They didn't have that. But like a washing machine or a car or whatever.
A ringer washer.
People were buying things on credit. Well, when it came time to pay the bill, they wanted to cash their stock in. But you can't cash in a stock you haven't paid for.
Yep.
And pretty soon, the whole house of cards fell apart. And J. Edgar Hoover was warned about this possibly happening. This, I mean, people say, oh, the Great Depression, you know, October of 1929 was this great, great calamity that just happened overnight. No, it didn't. It happened over a decade.
Yeah.
And when it happened, it was foreseen. People like Joseph Kennedy, Rockefeller, those guys, they didn't lose money in the stock market because they saw what was happening. You know, they didn't lose it. They didn't lose their fortunes. Their fortunes were mostly invested over in still in European banks and ventures and things like that. But their domestic holdings were secured. They sold stock and got their money back, sat on it, and they just laughed their asses off collectively when everybody else bottomed out. And then because people needed money, they would go to the banks to get their money. Well, the banks had to pay. You know, Woodrow Wilson created the Federal Reserve. Well, you know, Uncle Sammy got his cut.
Yeah.
And people made the runs on the banks, and people were locked out of the banks.
Well, the bank run thing in and of itself is kind of interesting because the stock market kind of crashed, and they worked to kind of build it back up, and it floundered for a bit. And the bank run didn't happen right away. It was a little bit further after. And
yeah,
the way the bank run, way I understand it from the documentary I watched, they kind of pinpoint it to one particular guy. Don't know the guy's name, but it's almost the modern day. It was almost like a pissed off customer on Twitter. Guy went in, said, hey, I don't like the way the wind's blowing. I want all my money. The bank says, well, we don't have all your money here, but we can transfer it over here, come back Wednesday, and we'll see what we can do. Well, the guy wasn't too happy about that in downtown New York, went outside, started running his mouth. Don't go in there. They ain't got your goddamn money. People start freaking out. They all start going in there. Everybody started demanding their money at one time. Well, newsflash, if you go to your bank now and say, hey, I need to withdraw $100,000, they're not going to be able to give you a sack of cash. They're going to say, hey, we got to either digitally transfer it. If you want money, first we're going to have the IRS wondering what you want to do with $100,000 in cash. But that aside, we're still going to have to, you know, we don't have it sitting in the safe. It's not there. And so everybody just went in, and once you had a whole lobby full of people not getting their cash when they wanted it, newspaper men got involved, radio men got involved, and it just spread across the nation, kind of like the movies from the 90s with the natural disaster or the bacteria of the day. They just showed that map where it's just getting big and redder and redder, and it's just spread like wildfire.
That's true. And also, you know, people don't really understand that after World War One, Germany was crippled financially after World War One. They were already in a depression by 1920. That people were living on like $3 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And but Germany had been the largest industrial power in Europe. Only the USA was an equal competitor, if not superior, to German industry. Well, German industry was not able to produce what the Europeans wanted. The Europeans wanted more American production. Well, American production requires capital. How do you get capital? People invest. Well, if you invest in a company, you expect to get a return.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that money went into the banks. Well, if the money's not in the banks to pay your shareholders and you can't pay your employees, then strikes were all over the place. I mean, iron workers, auto workers, you know, textile workers. I mean, people went on strike. What? I haven't been paid in 2 weeks. I'm not going to go to work if I'm not getting paid. And then, of course, the strike breakers came out, you know, and tried to say, you have to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so the turmoil was nuts. And I couldn't even imagine being alive at that time and having to deal with that, either as an employer or as someone who was wanting a paycheck.
Well, not only that, but you have these European markets, you got these worldwide markets who a lot of them deal with American capital. And America, the government's like, okay, we need cash. We need to start repatriating our cash. We need to start bringing our cash that's overseas, because unlike today where it's just a bunch of numbers in a digital bank account, very few people actually deal with cold hard cash. Everybody dealt with cold hard cash. And when it's not there, they started recalling it. And so now you have these other economies seeing a vacuum of the American currency that was in their system, and it impacts them even more.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, the first person is going to feel the impact is the guy earning a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And when that doesn't occur, questions begin to be asked. And a guy goes to his bank, like you said, and the bank says, well, we don't have your money here. Well, the average Joe is going to go, well, I put my money here. Why isn't it here? And when you have several million people asking that question, and if just half that number decide to take action on it, then you have a real problem.
Yeah.
And the government was not prepared for any of that at all. And the world paid for it because we were the financial center of the world even that long ago. New York, Wall Street, the stock market. I mean, the world revolved around the U.S. dollar and U.S. industry and U.S. capital. So when U.S. capital faltered, there was no backup plan. Nobody had a backup plan. Everybody suffered. And the people who suffered the most were those in Central Europe who had already been suffering heavily because of the reparations clause of the Treaty of Versailles. So I would say the Treaty of Versailles was step one.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Depression was step two in getting Mussolini and Hitler elected.
Yeah.
The people don't realize they were elected in a democratic election. We are a representative republic. We're not a democracy. I hate when people say that.
Yes,
we're not a democracy.
Too. We're not.
But in a straight democracy, you can vote that bastard out, which is one election.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they did, man. They're like, wait a minute. These two guys are telling us they're going to take us out of the depression, give us jobs, homes, food, and employ us and educate our kids, and we're going to be able to live a better life. And the Weimar didn't do anything for us. The Italian government didn't do anything for us. So, yeah, that's a good option. So people reach for the lifeline that they could get. Same with FDR. Herbert Hoover had totally screwed the country. I mean, he had totally destroyed the economy, and our national prestige was in tatters.
Mm-hmm.
Not as bad as what Biden's done now, but FDR ran on a platform of, hey, I'm not Hoover,
yep,
basically, and that was all it took.
Well, that combined with a few other things. So now we have the pandemic. I was in my mind thinking, well, something that sounds familiar. We had the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl in 1930, so we already had farms and crops missing. So we already had people through the Midwest and the major farmlands hurting on food, which obviously the farmlands aren't producing farms for the larger cities. So prior to this, you had people in the larger cities who were buying these stocks. They were living the high life. But people in the Midwest with the Dust Bowl, crops are hard to come by, couldn't breathe. And so everything just kind of came to a huge climax. And now you have the Depression. You got people out of work, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people out of work. The dollar isn't worth the paper it's printed on. And so you have these veterans of World War One, and they're like, hey, we need money. Where can we get money? I know. The War Adjusted Compensation Act of 1924. I served in World War One. I was promised money, a total of $625, which in Great Depression money is a damn good find. Problem was, technically, they don't have to give it to me until 1945.
Yeah, with interest.
With interest.
4% interest on your money in 1945.
I was 18 in 1915. It is now 1933. I got to wait another 12 years. The average life expectancy at that time before the Depression was 65-ish, kind of what they're hoping for if these guys would pass away before they had to cut checks. But hey, I'm going to go down to D.C. and I'm going to demand my money. And two particular guys started this from Washington State, and they started marching. And as they got publicity through newspaper and local radios, more and more veterans who had no jobs, losing their farms, literally losing their houses, nowhere to go. Hey, why not march with my brothers? I want my check too.
And a lot of people say, well, they had an agreement. They agreed to it that they would get their money in 1945. One thing they seem to forget, though, is because the House of Representatives ratified the previous agreement, the Adjusted Compensation Act, on July 28th, 1932. The Senate refused to ratify it. So therefore, when the Senate refused to ratify a House vote, it couldn't go to the president for signature or veto. So the senators were the ones who actually screwed the veterans more than Hoover did. But Hoover didn't care because he had already said, well, look, if you were owed $50 or less, you've been paid. And they did pay the people who were owed $50 or less. They got paid right off the bat. Bam, you're good. Sure. If you were owed more than that, then, of course, they said, well, we're going to give you 4% interest on your money, which is going to be invested until maturation, and you can get it in 1945. But as you said, a guy in 1932 who is,
living with the effects of gassing, the wounds he sustained in 1915, he's also now probably in his mid to late 30s, if not early 40s, depending on the age in which he served. And now you got to wait another 12 years? And oh, by the way, as you were saying, they agreed to it. We all know when it comes to the federal government, you really don't get an opportunity to agree. It's either take what we give you or don't. That's the agreement they had.
And even though the act was passed a decade before, in July of 32, it was revisited by the House of Representatives. And again, it was like shut down. Well, that word spread like the measles, because that's when guys came from every corner of the country as fast as they could. And when they, by the end of that second week of July, the estimates say 17 to 25,000 people were in the area surrounding DC. A lot of these people were on private property owned by a guy who said, hey, you can camp here. It's not on federal property. It's private property. They can't do anything to you.
Across the river.
Across the river, the Anacostia. And, but it didn't matter because the government could not have 17 to 25,000 people. A lot of them were civilians. A lot of them were family members. But they could not have that many people publicly demonstrating against the federal government in such an open way, because that really makes you look stupid if you're the Fed and you haven't resolved an issue.
And Colin just pointed out something very important. This is the Depression. As I said, people are losing their houses, people are losing their farms. So it wasn't just the vets. It was their wife, his wife, their kids, because they had nowhere to go. So they're all heading east. Now they're making a great migration east, starting from California. Everybody just started getting in this long march, hopping in old jalopies on donkeys, wagons, whatever form of transportation, the heel toe express, and they set up these Hoovervilles all through Washington. And
yeah,
one of the things the documentaries like to point out, and it's very true, despite the fact that the military was still segregated back then, despite the fact that you had all the racial tensions in certain states back then, all these bonus army camps, they were all desegregated. They were all living amongst one another because they're all fighting for the same cause. At that point, color doesn't matter. It's all about numbers. And so you had these camps where literally people were just black, white, didn't matter. They were all there. They all had a cause, and they were all brothers and sisters, and they were going to go down there and stand up and get their money.
Yeah, and there were some pretty notable people there too. Smedley Butler showed up, and he was really sympathetic with them, and a lot of other people were there, as well as, you also know, Douglas MacArthur, George Patton, and Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Well, that's
were there.
That's what I wanted to point out, because as a World War II podcast and a World War II amateur historian, a living historian, we hear about the greats, Patton, MacArthur. And then I hear this story, and not to skip ahead, so I want to tell it chronologically so we can reveal it to our audience here. What happens? They all start going down to putting up protest. As you were saying, it doesn't look good, and so we need to shut this down. So first and foremost, let's send over the police over to the Hoovervilles to shut these down. As you can imagine, some of them went home. If they had homes, some of them went to go find new homes, but a lot of them stayed because, once again, they had nowhere to go. Now they had what property they owned, you know, a mattress or a shack set up over here. That was their house. They had nowhere to go, and they needed this money. And so the police went. Rocks start getting thrown. People start getting pushed. Well, we can't have that, so let's send in the army. Now, keep this in mind. You got the vets of the war to end our war. The war, the only big war up to this point, protesting for money. And now we're not only going to send in the army, we're going to send in first-gen tanks. We're going to use gas on them. And infantrymen equipped with bayonets and gas masks. And shut this down. And who did they send to lead this? Please, sir.
Yeah, well, Douglas MacArthur, he was chief of staff of the army at the time.
Yep.
And he should have known better, because a lot of those men had served under him. And the same with Patton. In fact, one of the guys there was a private named Joe Angelo, who had received the Distinguished Service Cross for saving Patton's life in France. And he was wounded during the process. And he was there. And there are a lot of guys there whose names were known.
Eisenhower.
And Eisenhower, Patton, and others. But as far as the bonus army, some of the men in those ranks, yes, of those thousands, were people whose faces and names were well known. They were highly decorated men and relatively famous. And so it was very, very bad. It looked very bad for the military to have these former soldiers calling out the government. And then the D.C. police got involved, and there was a struggle there. People got hurt, and then Hoover said, just move the army in. And that was really a bad call, in my opinion.
And Patton kind of had a little bit of sense of not self-preservation, but hierarchy preservation. He went to MacArthur and said, hey, why don't you let a lesser known person, a lesser ranked person, deal with this, because you're not going to want to deal with the blowback if this thing goes south. And MacArthur's not like, I'm good. Let's let it roll. And it did blow up. People did get hurt. I know one woman ended up having, because not only, for the audience's sake, not only did they go in and run them down, but allegedly Hoover put out the standing order, don't cross the bridge. Whether he did or not, that's for history. MacArthur claims he never heard the command, don't cross the bridge. He sent his guys, his tanks across the bridge. One how or